Master, when we use the term Wali for Ali above him, referring to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and we call him Waliullah, it's not in the meaning of master, it is in the meaning of friend or somebody who is beloved of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
In the beginning of April 2011, the Syrian army was ordered to intervene after an increase in armed attacks on security forces in the city of Daraa. But it's safe to say that ordering the army to the streets was a hasty decision, because the intervention of military forces not only did not improve the situation, but also complicated it. What actually happened was the success of the opposition in trying to provoke the people in other parts of Syria and gaining international support. The intervention of the army was good media propaganda to achieve this goal, and the popular networks in the Arab world would regularly broadcast images of heavy weapons entering the cities. And people in contact with these networks would say that armed forces were shooting at the people. Syrian opposition forces.
Part 1.
Even though the military strongly denied the use of heavy weapons, no one believed it because of the intense media atmosphere created against it. The intervention of the army also provided a good excuse for Salafi scholars in Arab countries to incite the people against Bashar Assad. This effort began in Saudi Arabia and gradually spread to other countries. Although the speakers would greatly exaggerate what was actually happening in Syria, their words were accepted by the people because of the media atmosphere. The incitement of Sunni Muslims caused the Salafis in the Lebanese city of Tripoli to stage a protest against Bashar Assad. The protest of the Lebanese Salafis was significant because there were a lot of illegal border crossings in the north and east of Lebanon through which anyone could travel to Syria without any problems and transfer weapons and ammunition inside the country. Political activities also intensified with the spread of the protests and armed clashes between the Syrian army and armed groups. At a time when foreign countries had still not publicly demanded the resignation of Bashar Assad, it was necessary to determine what would happen to a post-Assad Syria. The problem was that Syrian opposition forces were not organized, and something needed to be done. A month and a half after the crisis started, Turkey began uniting the Syrian opposition, forces which could govern the country after the fall of Assad. The first official opposition conference was held in the city of Antalya and was attended by 300 opposition figures. The opposition also unveiled a new flag for Syria at the meeting. The new flag belonged to the time when Syria was able to liberate itself from being a colony of France and was known as the Flag of Independence. The flag was set aside in 1954, and now the opposition wanted to replace the flag Hafez Assad introduced as the country's official flag in 1980. On May 1, 2011, as the opposition forces were gathered in Antalya, Colonel Hossein Harmush, the commander of the 11th Division of the Syrian Army, announced in a video message that he had left the armed forces and formed a group called the Free Officers Battalion to confront the Syrian army. These events coincided with the arrival of the Syrian army in the city of Jisr al-Shughur on the outskirts of Idlib. And this was where the first clashes between the Syrian army and the Free Officers Battalion took place. The Free Officers Battalion attacked an army barracks in Jisr al-Shughur, killing 80 Syrian soldiers. Another group of soldiers who had entered the city to help were ambushed by gunmen, and 40 of them were killed. They fled to Idlib after burying the victims in a mass grave. When the mass grave was discovered, the Syrian government tried to show the world that it was fighting armed groups, not ordinary people. The Syrian army entered the city of Idlib to arrest those responsible for the Jisr al-Shughur massacre. They were able to arrest a number of them, but Hossein Harmush was able to flee to Turkey. During the clashes in Jisr al-Shughur and Idlib, some of the people in this region entered Turkish soil in order to prevent being caught up in the military operations. Turkey welcomed them with open arms and set up a camp for them near the border. Hossein Harmush would command the operations of the Free Officers Battalion from this camp. From then on, every now and then, video clips would be posted on the internet showing one or more Syrian soldiers announcing that they had defected from the army. Some would join the Free Officers Battalion. It appeared the Free Officers Battalion was seeking to establish a Benghazi-like region in the north of Syria. During the Libyan Revolution, defectors from the military were initially able to take control of the city of Benghazi and established it as the seat of their provisional government. They then took over the rest of the country. But contrary to the initial estimates, a short time later, Hossein Harmush and the Free Officers Battalion lost their importance to Turkey. A month after the establishment of the Free Officers Battalion, Colonel Riyad Assad, who was a commander in the Air Force, revealed that he had defected from the army and announced the official formation of the Free Syrian Army. The Free Syrian Army was much more organized and had more foreign support and facilities than the Free Officers Battalion. The Free Syrian Army's command center was in the Turkish region of Hatay, and every day more people were joining it. After the formation of the Free Syrian Army, the group was apparently given the task of creating a Benghazi, and Hossein Harmush was marginalized. A month later, in August of 2011, newspapers announced that Syrian intelligence forces had arrested Hossein Harmush in Turkey, and he was returned to Syria. The Free Officers Battalion officially accused Turkey of handing over Hossein Harmush to Syria. Later on, Turkish newspapers wrote that an Alawit officer in Turkey's security apparatus named Sakir Cioglu arrested Hossein Harmush and handed him over to the Syrian intelligence forces. Turkish newspapers claimed that this security officer had been arrested but managed to escape. But The Guardian wrote that Hossein Harmush was handed over to Syria by Turkey's intelligence apparatus in exchange for 7 Kurds who were accused of a bombing operation. A few days later, Hossein Harmush's confessions were broadcast by Syrian TV. As the Free Syrian Army's activities intensified, so did the Syrian military's operations. Due to the extremely high number of the clashes, the Syrian army resorted to the use of heavy weaponry, but the use of these weapons worsened the situation because the Free Syrian army used residential areas to attack the Syrian army. The use of heavy weaponry in residential areas inevitably caused civilian casualties, and what followed was the additional condemnation of Bashar Assad's government. But as the Syrian army was making its efforts to control the crisis, Bashar Assad continued with political reforms. One of the steps he took was issuing a general amnesty to political prisoners. Many of the people who were arrested during and even before the protests were released from prisons. Some of the released prisoners were Salafis who had fought in Iraq and Afghanistan and were in prison because of their membership in terrorist groups. But after their release, many of these people formed extremist Islamist groups against Assad and became senior members of these groups. The release of the Takfiri prisoners and their role in forming Takfiri groups was so effective that later on, opponents of Bashar Assad accused him of intentionally freeing them. They believed the motive behind the release of the Takfiri prisoners was that by forming Takfiri groups, they could take over the initiative from the secular and moderate opponents of the government. Bashar Assad ordered the release of the prisoners to lessen the attacks of Salafi scholars inside and outside of Syria. And it was obvious that he had no idea of the role they would play in the developments of Syria. At the time, Islamist groups had still not entered the battles in Syria, and opposition forces were trying their best to prevent the conflict from taking on an Islamist position. They believed that talk of the emergence of Islamist leanings in the future Syrian government would scare the West, and they would not allow the formation of an Islamist state which neighbored Israel. The Syrian Muslim Brotherhood, as the most powerful political opposition movement at the time, emphasized on different occasions that it did not seek to establish an Islamic government in Syria. 5 months after the beginning of the protests, on August the 9th of 2011, the King of Saudi Arabia issued a statement which strongly condemned the Syrian government. This statement was the beginning of serious political pressure on Bashar Assad. After this statement, the Saudi ambassador left Damascus, and following that, many countries cut off ties with Syria. At the height of diplomatic pressures on Syria's government, an incident took place in the Arab world which had an effect on Syria's crisis. Libya's revolutionary forces were able to enter the city of Tripoli and brutally killed Muammar Gaddafi. The downfall and death of Gaddafi raised the spirits of the Syrian protesters, who repeatedly promised the same fate for Bashar Assad if he did not step down. The Arab League had a decisive role in the downfall of Gaddafi. It condemned the actions of the Libyan government and army in response to the protests and had asked the Security Council to stop Gaddafi's actions. The Security Council issued a resolution giving NATO permission to create a no-fly zone over Libya. The intervention of NATO planes changed the balance of power in favor of the opposition. The Libyan army, which had already been weakened because it had delivered its strategic weapons to the West in an attempt to build confidence, was defeated. The cooperation of the Arab League and the Security Council caused the downfall of Gaddafi's rule in less than 6 months. Now, the Arab League wanted to use the same successful formula against Bashar Assad. The Arab League suspended Syria's membership and announced that it will send an observer group to Syria and make its final decision based on the group's report. The Arab League appointed a Sudanese general named Mohammed Addebi as the head of the Arab observer group in Syria. Aside from being active in Sudan's military, Mohammed Addebi also had experience in diplomatic efforts, and after retiring from the military, he was Sudan's ambassador to Qatar for years. Muhammad Tabi and his group, which numbers 166, entered Syria on December the 22nd, 2011. During several weeks, they visited different cities which were the scene of clashes. A month later, on the 21st of January 2012, Muhammad Tabi turned in his report on the situation in Syria to the Secretary General of the Arab League, Nabil El Arabi. But despite expectations, Muhammad Dabi's report was in favor of the Syrian government and told of the attacks of the armed opposition against Syrian forces. In his report, Dabi had emphasized that the Syrian army only targets positions which the armed groups use to attack them, and there was no intention in killing civilians.
Vladimir Putin and former president, current prime minister Medvedev, both of them have noted publicly what a tremendous mistake and blunder of historical proportions it was for Russia and China not to veto UN Security Council Resolution 1973 in Libya. And I think they took this situation in Syria as a, let's call it a second chance, an attempt to redeem themselves.
Before the Russian and Chinese veto of the Security Council resolution, different groups which opposed Bashar Assad were trying to hide their religious leanings. But when it became obvious that the Security Council would not allow NATO's direct involvement in Syria, Bashar Assad's opponents decided to bring down the government by strengthening armed groups and providing them with more weapons. Even though until then, the Free Syrian Army was still the most powerful armed group in Syria, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Turkey, which were Bashar Assad's most prominent opponents, decided to strengthen Salafi groups. These Salafi groups were more battle-hardened than the Free Syrian Army because of their beliefs and the experience of their participation in the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. Prominent Salafi groups, which became the stars of the Syrian crisis in 2012, had only been formed a few months before the end of 2011. But after Saudi Arabia and Qatar changed their policies, they were able to strengthen themselves with the support of these countries. The most prominent Salafi group, which announced its formation only 2 weeks after the veto of the Security Council's resolution, was the Front of the Supporters of the People of the Levant, Syria, or the Nusra Front. The leader of this group was a 31-year-old named Abu Muhammad Julani. Based on unconfirmed reports in 2013, his real name was Ahmad Hussein Ashara, and he was born in 1981 in the village of Ash-Shuhail in the Deir ez-Zor district. His father was a driver for a department in the Syrian army. In 2003, when he was in his second year of college, studying to become a doctor at Damascus University, he left his studies and went to Iraq to fight against U.S. forces and joined Al-Qaeda. In 2006, after the death of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, the leader of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, Julani left Iraq for a short time and went to Lebanon and started to train the Junta Sham. But after a while, he went back to Iraq to cooperate with Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the successor of Zarqawi. But the U.S. military arrested him and he was in Buqa prison until 2008. After he was released from prison, Abu Bakr Baghdadi put him in charge of Al-Qaeda's operations in Mosul. A month and a half after the beginning of the protests in Syria, Osama bin Laden was killed by American commandos in Pakistan, and Ayman al-Zawahiri took over the leadership of Al-Qaeda. But Abu Bakr Baghdadi did not accept the new leadership, and the conflict between him and Ayman al-Zawahiri grew. The conflict became worse when Ayman al-Zawahiri pledged allegiance with Mullah Omar, the leader of the Taliban. When the conflict was still not public, Ayman al-Zawahiri called on all fighters across the world to prepare for jihad in Syria. But Abu Bakr Baghdadi took a stance against the leader of Al-Qaeda and announced that jihad in Syria was forbidden. Abu Muhammad Julani and his companions began their operations in the Deir ez-Zor region in the last month of 2011. But the official formation of Nusra Front was in January 2012, and it was accompanied with a number of bombing operations in Damascus. Later on, the group released a number of hostages it had taken with the mediation of the head of Qatar's security apparatus, which showed that not only did a number of commanders, but the entire Qatari government was in direct contact with this group. The next three Salafi jihadi groups, which were effective along with the Nusra Front in 2012, were established by three friends. These three were inmates at Sednaya military prison near Damascus, accused of having ties with terrorist groups. The most famous one was Zahran Alush. He was the son of a famous Syrian Salafi named Sheikh Abdullah Alush. After learning the basics of religious studies from his father, he went to Saudi Arabia and attended the classes of the most prominent Salafi scholars at the Islamic University of Medina, such as Sheikh Abdullah bin Baz.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
When lawyers were preparing to defend against a lawsuit over a death in police custody in Fresno, California, they knew whom to call. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Jennifer Valentino DeVries, Mike McIntyre, Rebecca Ruiz, and Julie Tate. The piece is titled, How Paid Experts Help Exonerate Police After Deaths in Custody. When lawyers were preparing to defend against a lawsuit over a death in police custody in Fresno, California, they knew whom to call. Over the past two decades, Dr. Gary Wilker has established himself as a leading expert witness by repeatedly asserting that police officers and police techniques such as face-down restraints, stun gun shocks, and some neck holds did not kill people. Police officers in Fresno had handcuffed 41-year-old Joseph Perez and, holding him face-down on the ground, put a spinal board from an ambulance on his back as he cried out for help. One police officer sat on the board as they strapped him onto it. The county medical examiner ruled his death, in May of 2017, a homicide by asphyxiation. Dr. Gary Wilker, who was hired by the ambulance provider, charged $500 an hour and provided a different determination. He wrote in a report filed with the court this past July that Mr. Perez had died from methamphetamine use, heart disease, and the exertion of his struggle against the restraints. Dr. Gary Wilker, an emergency medicine doctor in San Diego, California, is an integral part of a small but influential cadre of scientists, lawyers, physicians, and other police experts whose research and testimony is almost always used to absolve police officers of blame for deaths. According to a review of hundreds of research papers and more than 25,000 pages of court documents, as well as interviews with nearly three dozen people with knowledge of the deaths or the research. Their views infuriate many prosecutors, plaintiff lawyers, medical experts, and relatives of the dead, who accuse them of slanting science, ignoring inconvenient facts, and dangerously emboldening police officers to act aggressively. One of the researchers has suggested that police officers involved in the deaths are often unfairly blamed, like parents of babies who die of sudden infant death syndrome. The experts also intersect with law enforcement-friendly companies that train police officers, write police policies, and lend authority to studies rebutting concerns about police use of force. Together, they form what often amounts to a cottage industry of exoneration. The dozen or so individuals and companies have collected millions of dollars over the past decade, much of it in fees that are largely underwritten by taxpayers, who cover the costs of police training and police policies and the legal bills of accused police officers. Many of the experts also have ties to Axon, maker of the Taser. A lawyer for the company, for example, was an early sponsor of the Institute for Prevention of In-Custody Deaths, a commercial undertaking that is among the police-friendly entities. And some of the experts have worked as consultants for Axon, the Taser maker. Another has served on Axon's corporate board. The New York Times identified more than 100 instances of in-custody deaths or life-threatening injuries from the past 15 years, in which experts in the network were hired to defend police officers. The cases were nearly all civil lawsuits, as the police officers involved were rarely charged with crimes. About two-thirds of the cases were settled out of court. Of the 28 decided by judges or juries, 16 had outcomes favoring the police. A handful of cases are currently pending. Beyond the courtroom, the individuals and businesses have offered instruction to thousands of police officers and medical examiners, whose cause of death rulings often help determine legal culpability. Lexipol, a Texas-based business whose webinars and publications have included experts from the network, boasted it helped write policy manuals for 6,300 police departments, sometimes suggesting standards for police officers' conduct that reduce legal liability. A company spokeswoman said it did not rely on the researchers in making its policies. The self-reinforcing ecosystem underscores the difficulty of obtaining an impartial accounting of deaths in police custody, particularly in cases involving a struggle, where the cause of death is not immediately clear. The New York Times reported earlier this year that outside criminal investigations of such cases can be plagued with shortcuts and biases that favor the police, and that medical examiners sometimes tie the deaths to a biological trait that would rarely be deemed fatal in other circumstances. Some researchers and doctors in this ecosystem who responded to questions from the New York Times said they did not assist law enforcement but provided unbiased results of scientific research and opinions based on the facts of each case. Several pointed to research demonstrating that police struggles overall have an exceedingly low risk of death. They also highlighted health issues that could cause deaths in such circumstances, including the use of drugs, obesity, psychological disturbances, and genetic mutations that may predispose people to heart problems. Some also criticized research and medical opinions that found that police techniques might cause or contribute to deaths, suggesting these were flawed. They also pointed out that other academic papers have been written by people who testify against law enforcement in such cases. Sensationalism, without offering scientifically demonstrated better control techniques, adds no benefit and merely exacerbates the existing tensions between law enforcement and the society at large, said Mark Kroll, a biomedical engineer who has backed the idea of an arrest-related death syndrome as an explanation of the deaths. Others in the network, including Dr. Gary Wilke, said it was wrong to characterize their work as favoring the police and suggested the New York Times' analysis misrepresented it. "I would disagree," Dr. Gary Wilke said when the New York Times shared his findings with him. Another of the experts, Dr. Stephen Karch, sent papers suggesting black males and people exerting themselves were generally more likely to have sudden cardiac arrest. Lawyers for Derek Chauvin, the former Minneapolis police officer who was ultimately convicted in last year's murder of George Floyd, also drew upon the same network of researchers and experts. In particular, they turned to the defense of prone restraint, a technique in which officers subdue subjects face down, as happened to George Floyd. The work of Dr. Kroll, who has a PhD in electrical engineering but no medical degree, was cited by the Chauvin defense as proof that putting body weight on someone face down does not cause asphyxiation. The experts have been called on to defend a broad range of other police techniques, including taser shocks and neck holds. Medical examiners and investigators have also relied on the research. Omaha police officers used a taser 12 times when detaining Zachary Bare Heels in 2017 and punched him repeatedly in the head and neck. Dr. Kroll, who sits on Axon's corporate board, the maker of the taser, testified in the criminal trial that the stun gun could not have contributed to the death of Mr. Bare Heels, a 28-year-old with bipolar disorder and schizophrenia. He also wrote a report in the civil case that is under seal. Police officers in Phoenix, Arizona, held Miguel Ruiz in a neck hold and shocked him multiple times with a stun gun in 2013. In a civil case, Dr. Gary Wilke attested to the safety of neck holds that cut off blood flow to the head by compressing arteries, and another researcher, Dr. Charles Wetley, discussed excited delirium, a condition that some doctors say can suddenly kill drug users or the mentally ill. Sheriff deputies in Kern County, California, handcuffed David Silva in 2013, bloodied him with batons, tied his hands and feet together behind his back, and pushed him face down into the ground. Two doctors in the expert network, Dr. Karch and Dr. Theodore Chan, agreed with the coroner's finding that David Silva did not asphyxiate. Dr. Chan cited studies he had done on the subject. Dr. Chan, who works in San Diego, California, with Dr. Gary Wilke, is also serving as an expert witness in the lawsuit over the death of Mr. Perez in Fresno, California. Citing his own research, he stated that there was no evidence that such weight on a person's back could contribute to asphyxiation. Dr. Wetley, a former Miami medical examiner who died last year, was among the first to publish research that launched what has become an industry of sorts defending police officers. He wrote in the 1980s about men who had taken cocaine and died, many while being subdued by police. He attributed the deaths to a condition he called excited delirium, when someone becomes aggressive from a mental illness or psychoactive drugs. Later in 1994, two former law enforcement officers, Michael Brave and John Peters, described in a paper what they called custody death syndrome. The condition, they wrote, had no apparent detectable anatomical cause, but could be associated with excited delirium or other vague diagnoses. In describing the death of a hypothetical suspect, they focused on potential liability. You immediately cringe at the thought of the critical scrutiny you will soon be facing by the media, by council officials, and by special interest groups, they wrote. The business of supporting law enforcement can be lucrative. Not all of the researchers testify frequently in courts of law, but when they do, experts associated with a network typically earn $500 to $1,000 an hour for testimony and depositions. Lexipol charges thousands of dollars in review and write policies for police departments. The Institute for Prevention of In-Custody Deaths also charges for its training programs and promotes its business partners. At the Institute's annual conference in Las Vegas last month, the price of admission was $695. The New York Times found that with rare exceptions when members of this network weigh in on a court case, they side with the police officers. Making determinations on death in custody cases is a complex and inexact process. The people being detained in the instances reviewed by the New York Times were often on drugs or in psychological distress, and some had severe medical conditions. But in death after death, the New York Times found actions by police officers and law enforcement fell well outside the controlled conditions in the research the experts cited to exonerate them in the courts of law. Occasionally, the experts use identical language in different cases to rebut allegations and suggest alternative explanations for the deaths. They also emphasize common ailments like heart disease or leaned heavily on the poorly understood notion of excited delirium.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me, proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away, proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim. Deen al-Islam, deen wal-ard ghayr deen Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jalad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We are going to be talking about the prayer rules according to the laws issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtaza Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up till 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching, one can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Well, Sheikh Javid, since we are talking about Ayatollah Khamenei's fatwas on the Islamic laws on prayer rules, let me ask you this question. If the time left for a prayer is short, can one skip all of his recommended acts and mustahabbat?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, obviously the recommended parts or the mustahab acts of prayer can be skipped at any time, even if the time is extended.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously it is not good to do so because yes. it's a kind of giving no regard to prayer. We must not belittle the prayers.
Mm-hmm.
And we must offer the prayers in the most perfect and most complete form. But if the time is so short, like, for example, you want to offer the Qunut prayer, but the time is short, and if you, recite the Qunut, you will end up offering your prayer out of time. So in that case, obviously, you can skip the mustahab parts. Like, for example, Qunut is one of the mustahab parts. You can skip, the Adhan, the Iqama, and also before the main prayer. And then you can also, instead of saying one Subhanallah, Tasbihat Arba, instead of reciting them three times, you can recite it once. And there are many mustahab acts which can be you know, skipped.
I see. Sheikh, if there's any time left, which is sufficient, in fact, for only one rak'ah of a unit to be offered within the prescribed time, okay?
Yeah.
Of course, the time when we say prescribed, we mean prescribed and limited for a prayer unit, right?
Yeah.
Can a person or a praying person make the niyat or intention of ada or qada?
Yeah, of course, he can make the niyat of ada. Ada. Ada means offering the prayer within the prescribed time.
Yes.
So if there's time left only for one rakat, and now imagine there is one person offering the asr prayer or the afternoon prayer,
mm-hmm.
and he has no time left, but only one, for example, 1 minute or as little time as it can be sufficient for one rakat, then in that case, of course, he has to make the niyyah of ada. In fact, his prayer is still considered to be a prayer offered within the prescribed time.
Mm-hmm.
So, generally speaking, if a part of the prayer falls within the prescribed time, that prayer is considered as ada prayer, and the niyyah should also be ada.
Mm-hmm,
yes.
See. Okay, another question, which is also, I find, challenging, is if a person offered the Isha prayer, all right?
Yeah.
He's under the intention that, under the illusion that there is no time to offer any other prayer, like such as the Maghrib prayer, okay?
Because, yeah.
With the same niyyah, with the same intention, okay?
Yeah.
So, obviously, he skips his Maghrib prayer and he goes straight to the Isha prayer. Okay? But he later finds out
mm-hmm.
that there is still some time left, like prescribed time for the Maghrib prayer. Can he offer the Maghrib prayer with the intention of Adha? Obviously, after the
Isha prayer.
Isha, yes.
Well, that's a good question, you know. It is permissible to offer, and it's necessary, in fact, to offer the Maghrib prayer, given the fact that that individual has already offered the Isha prayer.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the Maghrib prayer comes after the Isha prayer.
Yes.
In this case, there is no problem. The Isha prayer can be offered after the Maghrib prayer can be offered after the Isha prayer.
Uh-huh.
There is no objection. There is no problem. So if the time is left, and if there's a little time left, and this time allows him to offer the Maghrib prayer within the prescribed time, then of course it is necessary and it is permissible at the same time to offer Maghrib prayer, even though it falls after the Isha prayer.
I see. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Let's take a short break and we'll be back. Don't go away.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker, talking about the prayer rules according to Ayatollah Khamenei's fatwas on Islamic laws. Well, Sheikh, if a person is a debtor,
yeah,
all right, if someone is indebted and now they are busy praying,
yes,
or offering their prayer, and suddenly there is a knock on the door, and that's the sound of a
creditor. Yes.
All right. So, what is the Islamic rule about this? What should they do? What, like, is the debtor supposed to do? Should they, in fact, stop offering the prayer and deal with the creditor? or continue finishing it and then go and deal with the creditor?
The religious authorities have said that since paying the debt is very important, and repaying your loan to the debtor, to the creditor, is very important. Of course, the debtor who is busy praying should, if the creditor is in a hurry, and if maybe he is, he's going somewhere and he's knocking at the door, the debtor has to stop praying. He has to repay his loan and mm-hmm. then offer his prayer from the beginning. He has to repeat his prayer.
Uh-huh.
And this suggests how important it is mm-hmm. to repay your loan
yes.
in time, and to, of course, not to
postpone it.
Yeah, not to delay it, not to postpone it. And that is very important. For many of us, it is a kind of an instruction. For many people around us, we know that they are very much lazy, they procrastinate. Mm-hmm.
They are not sensitive about their loans.
Yeah, they are not
payment.
Doing anything to repay their loan, and yes. they are so easy and comfortable,
easy goal, yes.
not doing anything to repay their loan. Obviously, as I said, if a person is in a hurry and you are praying, you should offer your prayer, stop your prayer, and repay your loan. But if the time is extended and he is not in a hurry,
mm-hmm.
you should continue praying until you finish. And then you should repay your loan.
I see. Sheikh Javid, quite by mistake or inadvertently, if a person offers one of his prayers, all right, such as, for example, the Isha prayer before Maghrib, or the Asr prayer, the afternoon prayer before the Zuhr or noon prayer,
yeah,
are their prayers valid? In that case, by mistake?
Ayatollah Khamenei says, of course, the prayer is valid.
Mm-hmm.
No? If that happens inadvertently
yes.
or by mistake, you offer the Isha prayer before the Maghrib and Asr prayer before the Dhuhr prayer, so your prayer is valid because you did not do it intentionally.
Mm-hmm.
It happened all by mistake. So your prayer is valid, and it's not necessary to repeat your Asr prayer and Isha prayer.
Even if there is time?
Even if there is time, of course. Even if there is time, if you happen to offer your Asr prayer before
mm-hmm.
the Dhuhr prayer and your Maghrib prayer before the Isha, your Isha prayer before the Maghrib prayer, then your prayer is valid and it's not necessary to repeat.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. That was the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Rahmanun Rahimun Mannanun Kareemun Salamun Aleemun La ilaha illa hum Ghaffarun Jameelun Wahhabun Latifun Tawwabun Samiun Basir
is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 41 meters, 7300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastorday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.